Improving Public Preparedness Through National Public Awareness Campaigns, a public seminar presented by Robert Jensen, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs with the United States Department of Homeland Security. This seminar took place at the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University on the 13th of May 2013. The views and opinions expressed in this recording are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Australian National University. The recording has been edited to remove periods where technical problems occurred and to remove material for which we do not have copyright clearance.
Just while they're finishing up the last of the wiring, I'll start with the introduction and thank everyone for coming today. And it's my great pleasure on behalf of the Fenner School
put that
to
in
welcome
the back.
Bob Jensen to speak to us. Bob is the, if I get this right, the Principal Deputy Secretary for...
Assistant.
Assistant Secretary. Anyway, he's with the Department of Homeland Security.
Turn that on now.
And the Federal Emergency Management Agency in the United States, where he's a communication... he's been involved in crisis and media communication for many years, having served both in that role with the military, and I won't try and repeat his CV, which is available. So it's certainly a great pleasure to have him here to share his insights in risk and emergency communication, which is particularly relevant to at least some of us here in the Fenner School, because the Fenner School is developing quite a team or a research expertise in crisis and emergency management. The whole issue of public communication is relevant, whether you're talking about crisis and emergency communication or whether you're trying to communicate policy and policy change and how we want the world to go. So Bob comes to join us. He's supported in his visit here by the Fulbright scheme. He's a sponsored Fulbright senior specialist, and I welcome Pablo from the Fulbright Commission who's come to join us. He's also sponsored by the University of Southern Queensland, so we thank them for their contribution, and Emergency Media and Public Affairs, which is a not-for-profit organisation trying to increase public awareness, or more importantly, awareness within the emergency sector of the need for effective communication. So with that,
Hey, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate being able to speak to you today. And so, again, as I am told by my ethics lawyers that I have to say at the beginning of everything I do here, I am not speaking as a U.S. government official. I'm speaking as a private person, blah, 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 blah. Okay, I got that out of the way. I really appreciate the Fulbright, Australian Fulbright Commission for giving me this opportunity, and of course, ANU and University of Southern Queensland and EMPA for sponsoring me. They have a fully loaded schedule for me of about 50 events. I just had two this morning with Australian Defence Force, and I've got two this afternoon. We've got a bunch of things in 8 different cities. It's fantastic. And so I want to make sure you understand that I'm here to share information. I know that. And I got to find out if that story ever ran in the Canberra Times, where the reporter said, "Oh, you're here to advise the Australian government, are you?" I'm like, no. I'm not here to advise anybody. I'm here to share information. Oh, by the way, I'm here to learn as well. And in fact, I see some friendly faces here who I was with up in Australian Emergency Management Institute earlier in last week for a recovery workshop, and I learned a lot, some wonderful ideas, some very passionate people. I have to put a great shout out to the folks at AEMI for that workshop and for all the good that they do. So again, I'm going to share some of my thoughts and ideas on how we do things. I'm going to focus in on public awareness campaigns, but I'm more than happy to talk about anything. I'd like it to be a dialogue. So at any time, if you have any kind of questions, if you think I'm full of it, that's not... That's not how we do it here. That's fine. I'm a very, I've got very thick skin having done what I do for 30 years for the U.S. government. So, again, thank you very much. This is a great crowd here. And again, I'm hoping to have a dialogue with you. So I will try and go through the slides fairly quickly so that we can get to the point where you're going to ask questions of what you really want to hear. And although because I am being recorded, I will probably not be as candid as I was just now with the mid-level military officials. I will try and be as open and honest as I can about what we do. I think we do things very well in America, but I also think that we have a lot to learn. And I've been doing a lot of traveling. I was in London in March. I've been working very closely with our colleagues in Canada. The biggest thing I'm finding is that we're all facing the exact same issues. especially in the communication world, but even on the operational side, about defining resilience, defining recovery, and then on the communication side, we really have to learn how to do our public awareness campaigns better. So I'm going to talk about this and kind of use this as a channel to start our dialogue. But I really do want to get to whatever you want to talk about. So, okay, there you go, success. Okay, so. Obviously, any of you are working with, and many of you may be working very closely with groups that are doing public awareness campaigns, and they play a key role in the United States in our whole community approach. I want to talk a little bit about this whole community approach. So we're moving away from this government-centric notion that disaster happens and the federal government's going to come in and we're going to bring all these resources in and we're the only people who know how to deal with this disaster. Stand back, we're here to help. And we know that doesn't work. First off, you can't bring all the resources that you need. You're not going to be there as quick as you need to be there. And there's no way that the federal government can do everything. And so we're moving more towards a survivor-centric. And our messaging has changed quite a bit as well, to where we're not saying, we're the world's greatest emergency management agency. What we're saying now is, for example, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which runs all of our disaster response and recovery. We're saying FEMA is not the whole team, it's just part of the team, right? This is very, very different than what we used to say. And we talk about shared responsibility. The state has a responsibility, local government has a responsibility, the community and private sector has responsibilities. Oh, and the individual has responsibilities too. So we have been really trying hard to figure out the way, through public awareness campaigns, to talk about that shared responsibility, right? And the messaging is very, very important to make sure people know that they have to take action. And a lot of what we are talking about in our public awareness campaign is what we expect the public to do, all right? So we need to ensure that whatever the goal of our campaign is, it's got to be clearly stated. You can't develop a campaign and not say, okay, what are we trying to do with this, right? So three levels of goals. The easiest one is awareness. And frankly, that's what most public awareness campaigns have their metrics about, like how many people heard, right? How many people did the survey and said they were aware of this. Okay, that's great, but that really doesn't really do much. The next one is understanding or intellectually supportive. And here, obviously the, evacuations, right? I know it's important to evacuate, right? They understand why it's important. They say that, especially if the government comes and asks, right? What we found in government surveys is that many times they give the answer they think you want them to say, right? And so it might make sense to have maybe the Red Cross or some other group, non-governmental, ask the question. You might get a little bit more honest response, because no one wants to say to the Department of Homeland Security, we're not going to do that, right? So there's a kind of a bias that's built into some of these surveys. And of course, the last and the hardest to achieve is behavior change or taking action, which is really what we want them to do, right? I mean, this is the whole point, it's to save lives and or do something that will help achieve our goals. So we have a lot of campaigns. We have a law that mandates that on broadcast channels of radio and TV that they have to run PSAs. Of course, sometimes in the middle of the night, you don't get to choose. But many times they will run them, in decent hours. But all of them, or most of them, are public good related, right? Health and safety. And then others that are paid, that there's a whole bunch of public awareness campaigns out there that are usually some social cause. So you're competing, right? And this is the thing we had to understand. Is that the amount of money that the U.S. government has to pay for public awareness campaigns is never enough. It's like this drop in the bucket. And what I try and explain sometimes to senior government officials is the advertising budget for a single brand of toothpaste usually far outstrips our entire public awareness campaign budgets combined. So Crest toothpaste, they probably spend, $100 million a year doing advertising for, right? And we might be lucky if we have a total of $5 million for all of our Department of Homeland Security public awareness campaigns combined. And so there's a bit of expectation management there about what exactly you're going to achieve with that little bit of money, right? This is something that a lot of this will seem obvious, But when I talk with groups within Homeland Security and other government groups about what it is they're trying to do as they're planning their campaigns, understanding the target audience and speaking in their language, and that's a rule that should be followed on any communication campaign, but we in government, and I'm just going to admit it, we fail that so many times because we write the top messages the way we want to say it and how it's important to us, and we're not thinking about, okay, what are the concerns of the audience that we're trying to reach, right? And the number one thing is if we don't answer the question about why they should care, right? You know, everybody thinks that, killing baby seals is a bad thing, right? Right? But how do you tie that into what people do on a daily basis, right? Why should they care? It's a thing that we struggle with in terms of creating the campaign and creating the message and connecting with the audience in a way that not only are they going to get it and then they're going to intellectually understand it, but then they're going to do something because they care about what the issue is. And then, of course, making sure you look at the branding and you have a compelling tagline, something that's going to be easily remembered, which is different than your overall messaging. And then keeping the main message simple and impactful. I totally stole this from a guy related to the UN. I liked it, 7 C's of effective messaging, so I have to be honest and say I stole this from someone. But, the two things are cater to the heart and head, right? You know, if your messaging doesn't have some kind of emotion in it, right, and you want people to do something, you want them to take ownership of that issue, and you don't hit their head and their heart, you're not going to do that very well. Communicating a benefit in the messaging, I mean, that's, so if you do this, you'll live. That's probably a good one. I'm oversimplifying it, but do you see what I'm saying? You can't just say, hey, it's a really good thing not to start forest fires, right? Well, why is it a really good thing? What's the benefit? Why should I care, right? And then, again, and you'll hear this over and over again, and I'm talking about creating trust. If there is not trust between the messenger and the receiver, they're not going to listen, right? And that goes in whether you're doing a public awareness campaign, whether you're doing a town hall, right? Anyone who's here done a town hall after a major disaster, it's a very high-stress, high-outrage situation. People are upset. Right? They just lost their house. They might have lost some loved ones. They don't know if the government or any groups there are really helping them out. They want to know. And so, for example, after Hurricane Sandy, I made sure we had different town halls, and there were some very upset people who felt that they weren't getting things quick enough. And even though they already had their $32,000 max grant in their checking account, they were wondering who was going to come there and like rebuild their house, right? And so we had to meet with folks and address, and we had to do this. And I said, luckily I had federal leaders who got it and knew that you can't just, you know, well, let's just send another press release out. You have to actually get out there and do it. And the number one thing, and I said, let them vent. They're going to scream and shout, and you got to let that kind of get through. And the number one thing you have to do from the start is you have to make sure that they know that you care, right? That you understand their issues, you acknowledge their issues, you care, and you can't say you're sorry enough, right? Even if it's not your fault. And once you get to that point, then you can actually say something that they're going to listen to. This is the same thing, I think, with messaging for public awareness campaigns, right? It can't come across as kind of, well, sometimes it can. You can be a little preachy, and I'll talk a little bit about that, where the use of humor is a little bit tricky at times, but there has to be some kind of a resonance with the target audience. Big point: don't just tell messages. Don't just message. Tell stories about real people, right? And you have this campaign, and usually it's some kind of an issue where you've got all the reasons that people should care, and you're going on and on. And that kind of gets the awareness point and maybe even gets the understanding and intellectually supportive point. But you won't really get emotional until you tell stories about people, right? And they can go, oh yeah, I get that. And that's, you know, something that is not necessarily going to just be in, say, your TV or radio ads. That's going to be in part of the whole campaign when you're dealing with folks on a you know, much closer direct basis. Framing the issue, right? You know, what's the context of the issue? What's the background? Why is there a need for us to be worried about this? Our See Something, Say Something campaign. If you see something, say something, which is now a nationwide campaign that we have licensed from the New York City Metro Police. We put it in context by saying, you know, there's a lot of bad people out there that are looking to do something to us, and we don't have a police officer, thank goodness, on every single corner, right? And you, the public, have a responsibility to notify authorities when you see something suspicious. And I can't tell you how wonderful it was to hear every television reporter after the Boston bombings repeat that. If you see something, say something. Oh, that's great. So it's kind of resonating, and people get it. And in fact, that's what happened. How they caught young Jokhar Tsarnaev was a guy walked in his backyard and saw something odd, and rather than being a hero, realized that these guys are very dangerous, called the police, said, hey, I think there's something going on here. And that led to the arrest. The same thing with the Times Square bomber. You know, one of the street merchants looked up, saw this van there, and thought, that's not supposed to be there. Called the police. Police came, realized it was a car bomb, and took care of that. You know, made sure that a lot of people didn't die in Times Square. So this whole idea of the shared responsibility. And the people who are there, they know what's right and what's wrong. They know what's kind of different and what shouldn't be happening. I want to target influencers. So here's the other thing. You know, especially when you don't have a lot of money, right? And you're not pushing this thing. You don't have the money to have your TV ads and your radio commercials out all the time. You get the influencers in especially in communities, and you kind of work with them. So we work very closely, for example, with faith-based organizations, with local leadership, and we say, look, you know, this is kind of, especially in New York City. Recently, we've been working with the Jewish community and the Muslim community and other traditionally underserved communities to say, hey, we'd like you to help us get this message out. And by working directly with community leaders who are influencers, right, especially in the Muslim community in America, they're not necessarily going to trust the federal government, or they're going to be a little wary. But when we talk to the influencers and they go and talk to their community and they're the leaders, they're trusted. It's going to have a much greater effect. And so we don't want to say, well, hey, we have this TV commercial running, and it's running 100 times this year. That's not the end of your campaign. In fact, that's only a one-dimensional use of communication to get that message across. You've got you're competing against, you know, the barrage of information and really important things like American Idol, you know? So you're competing against those kinds of things for the attention span and interest of the public. So if you can use celebrity or pick messengers, you know, who have a great deal of credibility, we always can't, but if you can, try and do that. Something that I found, two things. One, when I came to FEMA, and we have a thing called the Ready Campaign, and my guys were really, really busy. They were going all over the United States. They were doing event after event, and I said, that's great. Because they were doing things. I said, can I see your plan? Can I see your execution plan? And they didn't have an execution plan. They basically were just, their execution plan was, we're going to go to a different city every 2 weeks, and we're going to do a bunch of things, and that's our execution plan. I said, well, how did you decide what cities you were going to? How are you dividing up the big sectors and making sure that we're hitting things? How are you even measuring what you're doing, right? They had no execution plan, but they were very busy, right? And I said, okay, that's not the way to do it. You need to say what your communication objectives are, and have a plan. And it's just like our private sector group. They were doing things every week, but they didn't have a plan in which they systematically divided up the private sector in America, which is huge, right? Said, okay, we're going to hit different sectors every year. And we're going to find out who their influences are. We're going to find out all the associations. We're going to systematically target all these groups. right? And that's kind of what I wanted to see. And so being busy is not the same thing as having a plan. The same thing with having a supporting media strategy. One of my team, was doing a lot of things with the public service announcements, and I said, "So what's your media strategy?" "Well, it's on TV." I said, no. "Yes, I get it that it's on TV and you've got a time frame and here's when the radio stuff is going and here's where the PSA is agreeing, but how are we explaining what this is and why aren't we talking to the media about this campaign and why we're doing it and why it's important, right? And getting them, so for example, to see something, say something, we did a huge push with American media, luckily, well before the Boston bombing, so they knew about our campaign, right? And so it wasn't, it was something that they could go, "Oh yeah, there's this thing." And they might not immediately cover it, and that's okay, but you have to kind of let them know what's going on. The Ready campaign, which is our preparedness campaign, every year before hurricane season, we do a massive outreach to the media, and we say, "Here's all the things we've got, and we've got this website, we've got these PSAs, we work with the Weather Channel, and here's how you can put things in your website for your TV station, whatever. Here's things you can tell the American public that they can do to be prepared for a hurricane or whatever." So we give them stuff, right? And so it's not about marketing the Ready campaign. It's about giving the media something that's useful that they can put out and call it, soft news, whatever you want to call it. But it gets that campaign out there even further, right? And by doing more than just saying, "Well, we've got a PSA up there." This is something that we don't do very well sometimes. I'm pushing my teams. Using outreach and two-way communication, and then making sure we incorporate community perspectives into the execution. So before you start doing these campaigns, and what will happen is you'll get some slicky PR firm come in there and say, "Yeah, we got this great idea, and here's the drawings, and here's what we're going to do." And my first question always is, okay, at what point are we going to do focus groups? At what point are we going to get input from our key stakeholders about what's important to them before we do the really cool, drawings of what's going to be on this campaign on the ads? Which, I mean, they got some really creative ideas, but if they can't tell me how we're going to make sure that those ideas are going to resonate and have meaning, it could be a really cool thing, but if there's no meaning, right, to the people you're trying to target, it's just a cool ad, which is okay, but it's not really meant to be what we're doing. And then, of course, Congress says, "How much money did you spend for that?" Yeah?
When you're trying to communicate to the whole public, to everybody, how do you segment your market? How do you find out
Right. So you bring up a point, because I get so many communication plans, and even not just public awareness plans, that have their standard audiences. The media, Congress, private sector, the American public, and I'm like, and I give my team a really hard time. I think if you have a way to reach everybody in the American public, then you need to go work for a company, an advertising agency, because you're going to be a millionaire. They all want to know how you do it, because there's no way that you can, in any given single effort, reach the entire American public, right? It ain't going to happen. And anyone who says they can, let me throw the little BS flag out there, because it ain't going to happen. So, which is why campaigns have to be long-term, which is why you have to look at a spectrum, and you can't just use one channel. So what we do is, and in fact, again, when my guys didn't have an execution plan that said what, well, they were just kind of meeting, right? I said, who needs to know this the most, right? And so obviously folks that are in very disaster prone areas, right? So you're going to focus down there, traditionally underserved populations. And in fact, that's one thing I'll talk about, that we don't do a good job of thinking about those traditionally underserved populations, multilingual, people with access and functional needs. Say, what about people who are blind? How do they get this information, for example? So you take the entire American population or entire Australian population, what have you, and you've got to now kind of, I don't want to call it prioritization, because, boy, if that word ever got out, they'll say, "Oh, well, these people are more important than these people." No, it's just who gets probably more impacted by disaster, right? And how do you, are you reaching those people? Because if you know you can't, you got X amount of money to do this, and you have X amount of effort and ability to go out and do this, why did you choose this city that never gets a hurricane, for example, over something in Florida, right? I mean, you have to be able to justify why you're doing it. And the way you do it is by looking at, okay, who's going to be impacted the most, and now I will try and reach those people, you know, at least concentrate on that, and then as I can through, you know, mass media, through our website, through whatever, we'll try and reach as many other people, and you're never going to reach everybody, but you got to try, but you have to have a rational, systematic approach to reach people who are actually going to pay attention, right? Does that kind of make sense? So it's not just a matter of I'm going to reach all, you know, people who are Spanish speaking. I probably want to reach all of them who are in hurricane areas. I'm just picking an example here. I want to reach all the ones who are in hurricane prone areas, right? Versus people maybe who are in Iowa. And you have to, and that you can defend that. So when people are complaining or the media is saying, "Gosh, you know, what are you doing? You're spending this much money," you can defend it by saying, "I'm trying to." Be smart and have the most effective use of taxpayer dollars, right? And the way what I'm looking for is not output, I'm looking for effect, strategic effect, right? And you're going to have more strategic effect if you're a lot more targeted than just by saying everybody is our audience, and that's not possible. Does that kind of make sense? Okay. Here's something else that we learned, developing champions across stakeholders. Right, we need to have, again, whether it's local community leaders, whoever, you need to have people who are passionate about what you're doing too, and incorporate them in how you roll out your public awareness campaigns. And they need to be a part of, for example, we in America, we have a group called Citizen Corps, and these are people who are really into homeland security and disaster response. So we give them training. We ask them to be a part of helping the local group and getting their communities more prepared. And they become our champions because we can't have we don't have enough people in Homeland Security to sit there in every single community. So we have thousands of these chapters around America, and we try and nurture those groups. We have awards every year. It could be something as simple as you give them a certificate and a pin to say thank you, and you have to acknowledge them. You have to thank them. Because they're doing stuff for you, and they are the face of what you're trying to do in the field, right? And bringing their community involved. The other thing we keep forgetting about is for people who are going to help us, right? We don't prepare collateral materials to kind of help them out. You know, just talk about our stuff. You know, let's give them a prepared speech. Let's give them, you know, materials to do presentations, right? So they don't have to figure it out and do it themselves. Let's make it easy on them to talk for us. And get that information out there. And then training. We don't do enough training for local champions to kind of talk about this. And I'm not going to say that we at Department of Homeland Security do this really well either. I'm just going to be honest with you. We're trying really hard to figure out how we'll do that in a better way. But it's something we acknowledge as an area we have to do better. And then a broad support system and use diverse activities. So it's not all just about a press release, or it's not all just the, you know, public service announcements free on TV. You've got to look at, we do things in schools. We partner with different organizations and let them, you know, help us tell the story. So for example, See Something, Say Something, we partner with Amtrak, we partner with many airlines, we partner with every major sports league in America, right? And they, during games, they play for us for free. And we get a captive audience, you know, who are there, and then they see our public service announcements, right? Go ahead.
I'm just interested in pursuing the question of champions a little more.
Mm-hmm.
How do you identify what kind of people you want to be champions? And how do you work out the people who are not suitable to do that job for you?
Well, part of it is. You just don't take anyone who comes along. You have to create relationships, right? And through those relationships, and it takes a while. So, for example, we are talking in America about the whole community. And so we talk about working. We have different layers of groups. So we work with the states. We also work with a group called IAEM, the International Association of Emergency Managers. So we have some kind of relationships ongoing. and we ask, you know, hey, do you know so-and-so? Is this, you know, is this person worth talking to? And it's not a matter of, like, there's some kind of test, right? And not all of them are going to do the same, you know. But usually what it is our champions tend to be community leaders that we have worked with, whether it's in a faith-based organization or whether it's in a community organization, right? It's people that we have worked with that that are trusted by their communities. Therefore, they're probably going to be okay, right? It's not like you, if some person just calls you up and says, hey, I'm really interested in this. I want to be a champion. You got to kind of check that out, because you could have someone who might have some issues, and then suddenly they become your issues, right? Because the person is a little unstable, right? Okay, you know, this happens. So that's a I'm not going to say that there's this checklist, right? But you have to do it in a very smart comment. And part of it for us is through the ongoing relationships that we're building with communities, because all disasters are local. Right, and it's that that relationship with those communities, in which you're gonna, if you don't have them when a disaster hits, it's a little kind of late to start building those, because they are already in a high stress, high outrage situation. Some of the missing tactics are always educating and engaging influencers, usually missing the real use of social media, right? What happens too many times in government, and we've been talking about this in like this morning with the military. I was talking about it, and I'm talking about it with emergency managers. One of the big problems with social media is most of us don't kind of know how to use that real well, right? And sadly, most government groups tend to use it as another distribution channel, right? So, hey, we put this press release out, we put it up on our website, we link to it on Facebook, and we're going to send a tweet that said, hey, we just put a press release out that you probably already have in your email box, right? And, of course, the people who get this barrage are like, okay, you put a press release out. Thank you so much. And they might read it. That's great. But what's missing, right, is the two-way conversation, which does happen. So we... I know FEMA within the federal government in the U.S. Does social media very, very well. And some of the discussions I've been having, like this morning, the military guys are saying, well, you know, how do you handle that? You know, it gets to be so much. Well, number one, you're not going to answer every, you know, they might say, you know, you're a horrible organization. Just because they don't like you doesn't mean you have to respond and say, no, we're the greatest thing since sliced bread, and here's what we're doing to help you. In fact, many times, especially if they're like wackos and they're crazy, by the U.S. government responding, we give them legitimacy, right? And we're not going to do this. We're not going to respond to every single thing. We're going to look at trends. We're going to make sure that we're working with influencers who have large numbers of followers, so if they retweet our stuff, it kind of gets it out to a lot more people than we could ever do. And then we need to make sure that we're providing information that's right, that's timely, that's useful, right? If we don't do that, then we lose the confidence and trust of the public. When we put stuff out, we did a lot of pushing back against rumors during Sandy, and we created a little rumor control page on the FEMA website that kind of became like Snopes, if you're familiar with that website where you go to check if something's real or not. And it was very, very successful. And we also worked very closely with local police. We had a lot of, sadly, every time there's a disaster, there are disaster criminals who seem to flock to them like, you know, moths to a flame. And we routinely put out information, during the recovery that says, beware of these types of things, right? You know, FEMA will never ask you for money up front before you get your money from the government, you know, because there's this big scam where they come around. They usually hit older disaster survivors, you know, oh, we're here from FEMA, and we'll help you get your money, but, you know, we need a $300 deposit, and you'll get that money back when you get your government check, right? Sadly, it happens. We also had a scam where it wasn't a scam, it was an absolute criminal act where the criminal organizations in New York were towing cars. They brought tow trucks from outside the state. They were towing cars and just, I mean, literally drive them right out of the state to chop shops, and or were cleaning them up and selling them, just basically stealing. So we worked with the local police to say, if you see a tow truck without out-of-state plates, call the police, because they're not supposed to be here. So we did things like that as well, which is useful, help people. So we had to, you know, but again, we're not going to, with the, you know, on it. If you ever look at what's called Tweet Grid, which is a matrix in which you can watch, you know, you can put terms in, you can see all the Twitter feeds on those specific, you know, Twitter, messaging. It was like a waterfall, you know, and so we had, you know, a table with, you know, five or six, computer set up with a whole range of feeds, and it was just like, you know, the amount of feeds that were coming out about Sandy is similar to what happened in the Boston bombing, and you can't possibly try to control that. You can't, you know, we had people above me saying, well, make that stop. Okay, I wish I could. You know, you can't. You don't, there's no way to control it, so you've got to understand how to feed into it and how to work against the trends to kind of create different trends in messaging. That's easier said than done. We're still learning how to do it. In fact, you know, that's one of the big discussions I'm having on my trip here is what are people learning in that space. Of course, I already talked about intergovernmental faith-based volunteer organizations. Now, here's another thing, making sure your internal audience is educated as well. If you got an organization and you're not telling your own people about your public awareness campaign, and then they're asked, whether by their family or friends or anyone, and they can't talk about it, you've got a little bit of a problem. And so it's really important to make sure that your own people and your organizations know what's going on. Developing relations with key community leaders. Now, here's engaging and integrating the private sector in communication efforts. For the longest time in America, we were like, oh, no, we can't have the private sector because they're just trying to make money, you know? We now have them integrated fully into how we do things. We have an exchange executive working full-time at FEMA in our communications operations. Whenever there's a major disaster, we stand up a thing called the National Business Emergency Operations Center, which is co-located with our National Response Coordination Center. And so we want to find out what is happening with the private sector, because there's no recovery without the private sector, right? And so the same thing with campaigns. I met with all the big box stores, right, like Walmart and Home Depot, things like that. And so we're putting up campaign posters in all of these stores. They're running our PSAs, you know, at the checkout counters. They run their own little ads. They're running our PSAs at their checkout counters. We're hitting millions of people for free, right? It's very, very important. We also have a thing with the American Hospitality Association, so that in hotels, you know, you turn on the TV and it's got like the little thing from the hotel. During disasters, they will run our PSAs and run information about where to get disaster assistance and disaster relief. We did that in New York and New Jersey after Sandy. So the people, not 100% of hotels, but the vast majority of them would run this stuff. And so we're using the channels that are out there within the private sector to get messaging out. Definitely making sure you're looking at traditionally underserved audiences. We do everything in English, and then we go, oh, shoot, yeah, we got to put it in Spanish. Oh, but hey, in New York, there's 100-some different languages, you know, that you have to deal with. You can't possibly put it in all of those, so how do you deal with that? We are looking at saying, okay, we can't put it in all those languages. We're going to put it in the main languages. But some of the print materials we can translate, we translate it into the top 20 languages, and then we work very closely with community leaders to say, hey, could you please help us and get this basic information out, you know, in your language to your community, right? We just don't have the money to do everything in 100-some languages. Things that most people don't think about. Anticipating opposition and complacency, right? Imagine, oh, hey, the U.S. government, you know, we're going to put something out. No one will be against this. It just makes sense, right? It happens all the time. But we tend not to anticipate it, we don't know what to, oh, my gosh, so what do we do? So we need to figure out, okay, what could happen? And then complacency, I know you all know that in the emergency services, you put messaging out and nothing happens. In fact, someone was telling me I'm trying to think of what exactly it was. There was groups that went out and they asked people if they would respond a certain way, and the answers, even after the bushfire that just happened here, was like 5%. So there's this massive problem of complacency, and I'm thinking you got to ask yourself why that is, and did they go back and say, is it this just you don't care? Is it that you don't believe us? Is it that we're not saying it in a way that makes sense? You know, so there has to be some follow-up to find out why that is. And I don't know that. And so, folks that are doing research into messaging during disaster response and recovery, I really am very interested in what you all are finding, right? Because language matters. Language matters, and those of us in the government tend to be too government focused and like, well, we're the government, we're important, and this is, you know, this is an important message, right? But we don't sit back and think, is it important to everybody, right? And are we saying it in a way that connects? And then here's the other thing: we always look at things in isolation. Everyone gets very, very excited about their own campaign, and this is the best thing since sliced bread, and they are so excited, but they don't think about, okay, what are we going out there against? You know, is there something similar, right? Are we, and what are we competing against? Considering humor carefully, it can backfire, especially when you're dealing with disaster. But I'm going to show you something that I borrowed from my colleagues in the UK, very appropriate use of humor, and it worked really well. Message fatigue is an issue for all campaigns, right? I mean, you all know it, and you have to just admit right from the start you're going to do a campaign. At a certain point, it's going to get old. By making the message personal and answering the question, why should I care, it helps that a little bit. But then you got to say, okay, I can't run this same campaign. I know in America they ran the Smokey the Bear campaign to death, and while it did work, just through sheer numbers of it running, you're going to need to say that I probably have to be willing to refresh, and while the message may not change, the approach has to change. And so we change the Ready campaign TV ads every year.
You talked about phase and wave in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to distinguish between, say, a cyclone and preparedness for cyclones.
Right.
I guess in part the question I have is, do you have a framework of response that you want from the community which guides you in terms of what you're saying at each stage of development of the cyclone? So, for example, you can avoid this, get out of town, which we all know about.
Right.
But do you actually have a frame for that kind of thing?
The framework of an established public awareness campaign, which has a specific goal, whether it's readiness, preparedness, whatever, right? That is going to be through your communication plan, right? And of course, the big lesson learned is don't wait to the disaster to start communicating. You're going to start communicating well in advance, and it's not going to be through your PSAs are kind of, and they're not the whole thing. They're just kind of part of your entire plan, right? So we're not going to create a whole new Ready campaign PSA that changes during the phases of a cyclone. We're not going to do that because it's really about preparedness, and then it's the other things we're doing, whether we're talking to the media, we're talking directly, or we're briefing the leadership. That's where the messaging changes as you get closer to what's going on, and once you move into disaster response, it may be if you're in the middle of this, don't go. You need to bunker down, and then afterwards, it's going to be life-saving, life-sustaining messaging, and then you move into the recovery, right? But you're not going to. That's not what you're doing through your public awareness campaigns. Your public awareness campaign should have a very clearly stated focus, and you can't do everything through the entire emergency management cycle in a single public awareness campaign, because absolutely, you have to. You have to link. So, for example, our preparedness thing, we link it to all the effort we're doing, whether it's pre-hurricane, whether it's just generally talking about disasters. That kind of makes sense. But you can't, don't mistake your public awareness campaign as your public communication through an actual disaster cycle, right? It's just part. It's just one piece. Know when to change course. If the plan isn't working, don't keep putting it out there. That's something that's really hard, especially if you spend a lot of money. But if you've done some focus groups and you got input, you probably won't have to change because it's going to be resonating. usually when you don't get that, you realize at a certain point, hey, no one's paying attention to this, and you got to rethink it. And that's the hardest thing, because in the government, nobody wants to admit that they failed. But it's a second failure if you don't admit you failed and try and do something different. You keep doing the same thing that's not working over and over again, right? Here's the other last part of sustaining the campaign. We don't ever think about that. So you get money this year, and you say, hey, I'm going to create this campaign, but who's going to run that campaign, for a long term? How are you going to budget for it, or are you just going to be like 1 year and that's all? You don't have money coming in the next few years. And I will admit that's a big problem we have, as we're going through major budget cuts within the U.S. government, finding the money to sustain our campaigns. It's been very, very hard. I've gone hat in hand to other program areas within the department to say, hey, can you spare a brother $1 million? And, I think anyone in any of these businesses understand how hard that is. But you got to plan for it, and you can't wait to the end of the year and go, oh, we've run out of money, and then go looking for money. You have to start looking right from the start, because as anyone dealing with government knows, it's a whole long process. You're thinking 2-3 years out as you're doing the budget process. Ensuring consistency in execution messaging and ensuring quality control and branding are very important, because especially if you're letting other people, be champions, you have to have pretty strict rules about what they can and can't do. You can't have them suddenly take your logo and change it we like your branding, but we're going to change the tagline because we like this better. Well, then you've just destroyed the whole purpose of what you're trying to do in creating, a large-scale brand. Here's the key campaigns we have. Ready Campaign, Disaster Preparedness. There's a whole website, ready.gov, that has a lot of different things on it. The If You See Something, Say Something, which is our public vigilance. Stop, Think, Connect, which is dealing with cybersecurity. And we have a great partnership with a group of IT and technology companies called the National Cybersecurity Alliance. And they fund a lot of this for us. We have the Blue Campaign, which is really just kind of getting going, and it's about counter human trafficking, which is a really difficult one for us, because as we're doing our surveys, the vast majority of Americans are like, there's no human trafficking in America. Mm-hmm. Or that happens like in China and Africa, this is very hard for us, and we're going through many iterations of figuring out how do we get people in America to wake up and go, hey, no, it's kind of happening here too, and it could be right next door to you, right? And so this is one where we're really working hard on the why should I care type of thing. And then one that we're working on right now to improve our traveler assistance, because we've got such a, after 9/11, we made it so hard to come and go from America. They want to know your entire life history. And we have to do a couple of things. One, people really are trying to, hurt us in America, and so we need to make sure people understand why they're doing this. We need to make them understand what is the process, and we have multiple bureaucracies that are kind of dealing with this, and so we're trying to make it easier for people, both Americans going overseas and people coming from overseas into America, and so we're creating a whole program which we are taking a lot of things that our friends in the UK did. They have a campaign called Know Before You Go. So here's a thing, Know Before You Go. I mean, that kind of quickly in 4 words says what this is all about, right? And this is our traveler assistance. So,
in Australia, we've got essentially those campaigns. It's spread across both state and federal governments. Know Before You Go, a smart traveler. The state government does the emergency management side or somewhere else. How do you see the impact of these multiple agencies and jurisdictions doing it in terms of compared to your single point?
Well, it's no different than anything else. Each one of those jurisdictions need to understand that they're not the only campaign out there. It's just like we know that we're dropping the bucket for the amount of money that's paid for other campaigns that are out there. We also have to understand we want to benchmark, right? So we try and share information back and forth, what works for you, what works for us. You're not going to be able to, you have to face the reality of any of those things. You're going to be competing for attention. And so the best thing that federal governments can do is to talk to each other and work together, so you're not countering what you're trying to do. But again, that competition for the attention of the public is fierce, you know, and not least of all, and what the government's putting out there is small amount compared to everything else that's out there, right? So let me see if I can get this. So a lot of these guys are well-known, umpires and referees, and people see them. So we're very lucky. I think only one of them was an actor. The rest were real referees and umpires. And then they play that at all these games, right? So the value of that, of teaming with these major sports, was incredible. We saved millions and millions of dollars. So this one, you know, when I first saw it, I kind of went, what the heck? But it resonated really, really well with focus groups. Because you're watching it, you're like, okay, it's kind of got this little sound. And then the end comes and you go, oh, yeah. And it really, really has resonated about, you know, because we're not being preachy, saying, you know, you must be prepared. But it just kind of said, okay, here's the deal. In a very subtle way that I thought was very, very useful. And
could I just ask on that one?
Yeah. Oops, sorry.
Who came up with that creative idea?
There's a thing called the Ad Council in America, and they work very closely with the U.S. government in creating these kinds of ads. And I think this one was one of the, trying to get the name of the firm, is one of the top PR firms, and they donate their creative and they donate their time to create this, and then work with us to help get the best placement of the PSAs. And so these were actual professionals that do this stuff for a living. And so we're very, very lucky, very, very pleased that they partner with us. Let me do just one more. This is a use of humor that my friends in the UK. Okay, so there's good use of humor, right? And anyway, so I just wanted to kind of end there, and I don't know if we have any more time or we're done, so.
Well, I didn't have the time, and the flyer said we end at 12. We've actually got this room booked for a while, so I guess the thing is, we're in your hands, Bob.
Sure.
I need a break. If people want to ask questions, hang around.
I'm happy to take questions now.
Need to leave because it was 2 o'clock. Now might be the time to quietly slip out the back door, but otherwise, if you're happy, we'll just...
I'm happy, whatever. Yes. Just speak up.
Well, you mentioned that one of those public awareness campaigns, the message resonated with focus groups. But in terms of evaluating effectiveness of a campaign, how do you define and measure the success?
Okay, so there's...
Is it the uptake of the message during, after, or the actioning of the message?
Well, you're going to have multiple layers of effectiveness, right? And you have to do... So being a government bureaucracy, we have to look at reach. So we're measuring reach. Number two, we're looking at... in those focus groups, how well they said that impacted them. And then third, you're looking at preparedness. When we do surveys of preparedness in certain areas, we see is the preparedness going up or is it going down? After Katrina, preparedness across America went way up. And then we, the federal government, were messaging that, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And so people went, well, why should I do anything? The federal government's going to do everything for me. Preparedness went way down. And so it's a hard thing because unlike selling a widget or selling toothpaste, it's very, very difficult to actually measure, right, impact of this. And we don't have a lot of money and the ability, and there's certain laws about us surveying the public. So a lot of our, and to be honest with you, a lot of our metrics comes in afterwards in which we're talking to, and we go into disaster areas and we say, did you see any preparedness stuff? We actually ask disaster survivors, what kinds of things that they remember, and did they see anything like this, right? It's not easy, and I'm not going to say we have all the answers because we don't. It's the hardest, the metrics is the hardest part, and we're still learning. Again, I'm listening to things that are being done here in Australia in terms of measuring and hoping to take some good ideas home. So I get it, but you know that it is truly important, but it's the hardest thing for us to do, to be honest with you. So I don't want to make believe that we were doing something else. Yeah.
Name's John Scott. I'm from the Australian Risk Policy Institute. I just want to introduce you to another way of thinking about the problem. That is to work backwards from the action through the social networks. Mm-hmm. In a prior life, I was a senior Commonwealth Public Service servant in the Health Department, and there's nothing worse than trying to use the health sector medical professions to work with. But what we did was, like your messaging there, like Ready to Go or The Day Before, etc., What we were looking for was something which we all could agree would be worth doing, a virtue,
right,
and then set out to create some kind of collaboration mechanism which would then engage them in an effective way to identify things that were practical as far as they were concerned and worth doing. As far as trying to control messaging into those groups, what we did was the thing called chain chasing for trust. What we specifically asked people to do was tell us, if you couldn't be here, who would you trust to be able to reflect your views and interests? And we chased them all the way up to the highest level, because by having that person involved, we then were able to bring whole communities along.
That's a great idea.
We know, like you know, that organization position holders are not necessarily the trusted ones.
Right. Could be the highest co-principal.
Exactly. And then from the point of view of messaging, we actually asked them to help us compose the message in their language, because we know it has to be meaningful, accurate, and trustworthy.
Right, right.
But it also has to come through the right channel. And so if that means they have to stand up, well, then they stand up. If it means somebody else has to stand up, e.g. an independent party who can say these people are doing good things, then that's what we did.
Yep.
Now, we've taken that knowledge and experience, and we're now applying it to rethinking risk and dealing with systemic risk.
Right, right.
And so I simply share it. Happy to share some more with you.
That would be great. I'm open. I'm learning a lot here. That's fantastic.
Because we're particularly concerned about messaging to the community in times of extreme events, but we also recognize, and that's why I asked you the question about the linkage between the long-term public campaigns and the connection into the event as it unfolds and with recovery or with survivability and recovery being propositional, preparedness may well be the only thing we have standing in the way.
Right, and as I say, the public awareness campaigns are one piece, and definitely you have to make sure, and so you're not gonna get through to people if you don't include their perspective. And so I appreciate that, and I would like to learn more about what you're talking about. So, great. Anyone else?
I was just wondering what your perspective might be about the information campaign around climate change, and you know, there has been a concerted misinformation campaign from some areas to confuse the public, and it's basically been effective. If you were heading up a campaign to clear up the communication around climate change, like, where would you start, or would you say it's completely under-resourced or virtually non-existent?
Well, okay, in America, we're having a huge debate about climate change. You've got certain groups. I mean, I'm sure you've seen some of the debate that's happening there. From a government, federal government standpoint, our policy with the current administration is that we are going to address things that the U.S. government can do with regard to climate change, and the fact that we're seeing a lot more extreme weather events. And regardless of what anyone believes one way or the other, it's a thing that could be happening, and it probably is happening. And so what are we going to do about it? We're not going to wait till, you know, all the icebergs melt and we're all underwater. And so our approach is to basically say, here's what the federal government is doing with regard to climate change. Not a debate. We're not debating, right, whether there is or there isn't, right? Because that's not what you have to do. The discussion in our communication is about what we are doing, right? And we're not debating it. And I think when you get into a debate, frankly, as a government, do we debate everything? it's not an easy thing. So I don't know that I have. I think the science is out there, and I think. Here's the thing. Again, it comes back to, why should I care, right? The vast majority of the public, if you can't put in a term that they understand that they should care about it, right? You can have all the science in the world. We had that issue with Fukushima, right? Where suddenly people were putting the little plume maps out. Oh my gosh, the plumes are coming over America and everyone's going to be fried with radiation. That was a huge issue for us, and people were running out buying the KI and, you know, people saying, hey, you know, you shouldn't take that stuff, you're going to get sick. And so we carted out top technical experts to talk about, you know, the fact that, hey, by the time it gets here, it's going to be so dispersed, you know, blah, 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 and we tried to explain that. And the bottom line, it came down to where we had to put Environmental Protection Agency surveillance teams in California and all up the West Coast to say, okay, we're monitoring, because that was the concern. And once we addressed the concern and said that we're monitoring, yep, just like we said, there's really not anything to worry about. But until we did that, right, you could say anything you wanted. You could point all the scientific facts out. Until we did something to address the real concern that people had, it was a real concern. It wasn't necessarily a real fact, right? And so we had to. So that's a little something I think we learn from some of these issues. It's a very complex issue, right? The complexity around climate change. There's so many different positions. So what do you do, right? You'll have 100 scientists line up and say, nah, not happening. Another 100 who will line up and say it is. And then who's right? Right. So we in the U.S. government are basically saying, here's what we're doing. You know, we're looking long term, and these are the types of things that we're doing to address the potential issues that could happen should this happen. Right. I think I kind of danced around that answer. Right. Anyone else?
Yes. Two things. One was just to point out, if you haven't seen it already, about use of humour in ads. Is the I think it's the New South Wales government had some very good ads running over summer about evacuation preparedness for fire emergency. I'm not sure if you've seen them.
I have not, but I'm going to probably ask. I'm going to be working with Phil Campbell and those guys, and I'll ask them if they can get me copies.
A plan to have a plan is not a plan.
Right.
I thought it was fantastic. Yeah. I think there was two different ads.
That would be great. I look forward to getting copies of those.
My question to you is the area that I work in specifically is working with first responders. Mm-hmm. Do you have any specific communication strategies around directed towards first responders in any phase of an emergency?
Absolutely. They're part of the whole community approach, right? So when we're talking, they're one of the key stakeholder groups that we're talking to, whether it's at the federal, the state, or the local level, and we are talking with them on a constant basis, right? And the way we kind of do it in the communication world, we have multiple communication lines. So we have a line that has all the federal communicators that when a major disaster happens or an incident happens, we get on the phone and we say, okay, who's doing what? And the White House will tell us who's in the lead, and here's what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do in the first few days or first few hours, first few days we're going to do. And so everybody, we have great message control that way. We have a second line that brings in the state and local officials, and usually they are the communicators, right? And whether it's for the emergency management, Homeland Security, could be police, all their communicators get on these lines, and we say, okay, here's what the federal government knows, and here's what we're going to be doing and saying. We'd like to know what you're doing and saying. We want to make sure that we're working hand in hand. Are there things you don't want us to say, or are there things that you want us to support? And then we have a third line that we deal with the private sector, for example, and we get all the communicators for all the major private sector corporations, and we talk to them and say, here's what the federal government's doing. Oh, by the way, here's what state and local are doing, just so that they know what to say to their employees and people that they're overseeing. So again, when you talk, and then on the operational side, the operators definitely up and down the chain, we're working with them constantly, whether through video teleconferences, whether through teleconference calls, or whether on the ground. During a disaster, we've got people there working side by side with all of these emergency managers and different folks. Does that kind of answer your question? Yeah. Now, no, it's important. We have to talk to them, both in what we're saying and then what we're doing.
That's the last one.
Yeah, g'day, Robert. Over the last couple of years, we've had pretty severe floods and fires within New South Wales, which is the area that I work as an emergency management officer. Have you had the understanding that sometimes your campaigns to educate the public are too good, that you develop maybe too much of a learned dependency for the community to rely on our combat agencies or our agencies to provide information?
Well, that's kind of what happened with not so much the campaigns that we had, but the messaging that the federal government was doing after Katrina. We're the preeminent emergency management agency in the world, and we're going to do this and this and that. And so we were not messaging We were messaging about all about our competencies and how good we were, and that kind of corresponded to a related downfall or a down turn in preparedness, because people said, well, why should I do anything? The federal government's all prepared. They're the best in the world. That's when we, when the Obama administration came in, we said we can't do that. You know, we can't. Your first responder is probably your neighbor, right? So the federal government is not going to come swooping in like the second after the rain stops and fix things. And so we've got. So our messaging absolutely does say now it's a shared responsibility, and you, the American public, have responsibility as well to take care of yourself. And if you're able-bodied and you're not doing that, you're taking away from assets and resources and capabilities that other people who probably really need it, right, they're not going to have that now because now you've suddenly become a problem. So we're getting less and less subtle about that. But it is very, you know, you see like our National Weather Service saying, you know, people are going to die. You know, we had a governor of a certain state said because we don't do evacuation notices, but states do. We always say listen to your local officials about evacuation. If they say evacuate, governor of a certain state said if you do not evacuate, you will die. So they're getting a lot more straight to the point, and you kind of have to because it should be no surprise that people who don't listen, then something massive happens. Their people are going to die. So does that kind of answer your question, Eric? Great. Well, thank you very much.
My final comment on that is the problem we have is our message for emergency help in floods and storms is call 1-3-2-500, not for emergency help in floods and storms. Sort it out yourself. All right. I'd like to thank Bob for coming to speak to us.
Thank you.
Hopefully that's given us all something to think about. Bob, as a souvenir,
all right.
Present the official Fenner School hat.
Thank you so much.
That's usually reserved for people who have just graduated. But,
okay.
You know.
Well, I appreciate that. I'll wear it. Great.
Okay.
All right.
We're for those, there are some in the room, we have a special class for our HDR PhD master students. That's back in here in about 15 minutes, so Bob will have time for a cup of tea. There is a flyer at the back of the room somewhere about emergency media and public affairs and their upcoming conference. So if you have a further interest in this sort of field of emergency communications, please grab that. Certainly, EMPA would like to hear about you, hear from you, and the conference is well worth coming to, and Bob will be speaking at that again. So thank you, everyone, for coming, and
thank you
Bob,
very much
for your presentation.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate that.